Before we get into today, make sure you subscribe to the podcast on any platform, whether it's Spotify, iTunes, or Google Podcasts. And that way it lets me know that the content I'm putting out there is reaching your ears and you want more content like this. So with that said, let's get into the show. Today, I wanted to welcome on Chris. First of all, Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Amanda. I'm grateful to be here.
So tell us about yourself, Chris. Why are you here? What are we talking about today?
So I'm an author and anxious attachment style coach. I've worked with hundreds of clients all over the globe to help them have healthier relationships, both with themselves and with everyone in their lives. Mm. So using a trauma-informed approach, taking the lens of attachment theory as a framework for better understanding both ourselves and how to have healthier relationships. I've worked with clients on 5 continents, including Australia.
Yep.
And, you know, I've really brought my approach from my own experience, helping to coach them into the healthiest relationships they've ever had.
Mm, amazing. But why, more importantly, why are you drawn to this kind of work?
I got drawn into this because finding out and discovering my own attachment style was a watershed, game-changing, groundbreaking moment for me. Mm. It really helped to put a label to a lot of disparate experiences that I had had throughout my life that led to me looking at relationships as a way to fill a kind of void in me. You know, I experienced a lot of trauma growing up and unfortunately reinforced a lot of that trauma with the decisions that I made as an adult in the relationships that I maintained and kept. And so, you know, discovering that really changed my life. It made everything made sense. It gave, you know, a label for something that made me feel deeply ashamed, that made me feel like there was something wrong with me. Like I was broken and crazy and needy and clingy for, you know, wanting closeness and reassurance in a partnership, for wanting someone that was really present in a relationship with me. And of course, you know, that really went back to my childhood where I experienced emotional abandonment in various forms, emotional and sexual abuse. And so now I'm helping my clients to, you know, really accelerate their healing by learning everything that I've learned so they don't waste years of their lives. And again, reinforce trauma from their past by the decisions they're making now.
For sure. Okay. So lots to talk about today. Are you open to talk about sort of how?
Absolutely.
Who did you suffer the sexual abuse from? And the abandonment from, if we're talking about family, because that's, I guess that's where it all starts, right?
Yes, absolutely. For many people, that is true. For me, it is true. Mm. Although folks listening to this, you know, might think, oh, I had a great childhood and, you know, nothing was wrong. It's not always what happened. Sometimes it's what didn't happen or what we didn't get that can be traumatic. So something for folks listening and watching to consider as well. But for me, my trauma really started when I was 2 years old. That's when my parents divorced. And even though I don't have, you know, physical memories of the event, your nervous system, which is wired for safety and protection, it has imprints that are left upon it by all the experiences that you go through, no matter what your age is. Mm. So it really started then. And my dad got custody of my middle sister, Michelle, and myself, because my mom was an alcoholic and she was, for the most part, deeply unstable. Although, of course, had periods where things were looking up and she was sober and, you know, it wasn't always so black and white. But when I was 5 years old, my sister Michelle sexually abused me. She was 9 years older than me. And she had found out the year before that my father was not her biological father. My mom, in a drunken stupor, informed her of this. And as you can imagine, at 13 years old, it changed the trajectory of her entire life. You know, her world was completely turned upside down. Part of the healing work I've done in the years since is realizing that she was projecting pain onto me that she didn't know how to handle. Controlling me, and sexual abuse was one form of that control. There were other forms of control she tried to extort or exert over me by blackmailing me through the years. But ultimately, that's where the sexual abuse occurred, in the nuclear family for me with my middle sister. And, you know, it wasn't until she passed away from an overdose that I had these memories that were repressed. Wasn't until my sister passed from an overdose that these memories came flooding back. I recalled some of the intimate details of what happened and felt a lot of sensations in my body that I had dissociated from over the years as a form of protection and survival because of how young it happened. I was very much powerless. You know, I'm 5 years old. I don't really have a good grasp of what's going on in the world. Yeah. And that was just really the tip of the iceberg. When I was 8 years old, after being in a period where my parents shared custody for several years and we were in a regular pattern of my sister and I going to visit my mom every other weekend, her second husband got a new job 1,000 miles away. We were living in Maryland in the United States and she moved to Florida. So, you know, instead of a half hour car ride, it was, you know, a 2.5 hour plane ride to go and see her. So I went from seeing her twice, maybe three times a month to twice, maybe three times a year. And, you know, that kind of shift for an 8 year old boy is a lot to take in. You know, I really craved that closeness with my mom. And for me, that's where a lot of my anxious attachment stems from, is the relationship with her.
Yeah.
She lived in Florida from when I was 8 until I was 18. And in those 10 years, I spent going back and forth and in this pattern of, you know, counting down the days until I would get to see her and looking forward for months until, you know, these trips. And then, of course, ultimately, the time that we shared together would come to an end and I'd have to fly back home to my dad. And I would be despondent, just listless, depressed for weeks afterwards. And, you know, then the cycle would begin again, another countdown, another flight, another trip, another depressive episode.
Welcome to this short ad break. Not sure if you're aware, but I'm a personal trainer and have been for years now. So if you like the idea of training and being educated on how to eat for better health, then maybe it's time to hire me as your personal coach. You can start feeling confident, self-assured, and healthy again, so you can attract the best kinds of lovers and friendships into your life today. You can apply for online or face-to-face coaching with me, where I will take you through a hybrid fitness system that covers the three pillars to success, where I take you through the deep work of mindset principles and help you achieve breakthroughs, guide you to understand meal preparation for your goals, and customize your weight training program to help you build a healthy physique that you can be proud of. Find the application link in the show notes of this episode. Back to the show.
And, you know, I recreated this pattern.
In this whole period, she was still drinking?
Still drinking, yes. She ultimately passed away when I was 18. Her alcoholism consumed her. Her body let out.
Wow.
She died of organ failure. And so, you know, not only my sister, my mom, and my mom's mom before her, three generations of women on my mom's side wiped out from addiction. And in my 20s, recreating this pattern of distance, I ended up dating guys long distance, even though I was living in New York City at the time. I've since moved to Charleston, South Carolina. I would constantly, you know, be traveling either for work or pleasure and meet someone, and then we'd hit it off. But I was never meeting anyone in New York City. And that's because I learned that love was meant to be felt at a distance. I also ended up dating a lot of avoidance, you know, getting back into attachment theory as kind of a framework for understanding healing. And looking at that pattern, I also recognized I was coping with my emotions in a lot of very unhealthy ways. Drugs were never my go-to. Alcohol, yes. Sex and casual sex with lots of random men, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it took a very sobering moment for me to take a look in the mirror and realize I'm behaving in a lot of the same ways that my mom's mom did, my mom did, and my sister did. And if I didn't change, that my trajectory could be equally as bleak.
So what was the turning point then? Like, how long ago was that? And then what kind of work did you do on yourself to start understanding yourself at a much deeper level and obviously your traumas as well?
My healing journey really started in the wake of my mom's death when I was 18. That's when I first started seeing a therapist. I was also studying in college at the time, psychology as my double major. So I've always naturally been curious about what makes people tick and also myself. And so, you know, throughout my 20s, yes, I struggled. I was still learning about myself, reading a lot, doing therapy on and off, not really making a whole lot of progress because I hadn't really fully recognized the patterns that I was in and how I was perpetuating dysfunction in my adult life that I had picked up in childhood and in early adulthood as a teenager. So it wasn't really until my late 20s, early 30s, where I started to make some real progress in my healing. And it was actually a relationship with an avoidant who lived in Chicago, Illinois, here in the States, that was devastating for me. I mean, it was a situationship. It was super intense, really passionate. We went to college together and reconnected after 10 years. And it was just, you know, hit the ground running, off to the races, super intimate, really, again, that chemistry through the roof. And, you know, when he pulled away several weeks later, after us talking on the phone and FaceTiming for hours a day and texting constantly, that was incredibly triggering for me and led to me behaving in old ways, in protest behavior or kind of lashing out or, you know, things like that. And that situationship crashed and burned just as quickly as it, you know, came to fruition. And I just decided enough is enough. I can't keep doing this. This isn't sustainable for me. I had, again, made progress throughout my 20s in certain ways. When I was 25, I realized something's not quite right here. And I actually took 6 months off from dating and hooking up, just completely cold turkey, just focusing on me, learning how to set better boundaries for myself. And that was one of the most healing times of my life. I actually fell in love, not once, but twice after that experience. So it's not that, you know, healing is linear. And I want people who are listening to this to understand, you know, there's no such thing as being perfectly healed or perfectly secure. There were moments and periods where I made a lot of progress and then periods where I took a couple steps back and had to learn things the hard way again, and then made some more progress, read some more really foundational books for me and had powerful sessions with a new therapist. But now in my late 30s, I obviously see things through a different lens. And now doing the work that I do with my clients, it's helping me to live a sense of purpose and help other people not make the same mistakes that I did. So it's also helping me on my own healing journey. These days, I'd say I'm probably 75% secure, 25% anxious. I still experience anxiety. I still get triggered. I want people to understand it's not about perfection. And obviously my childhood wounds go back to some of my earliest years, earliest memories, earliest relationships. It takes time for those arcs to complete themselves in your life. And that's certainly been true for me. But the older I get, the more work I do on myself, the more I do this work with clients, the more it helps me to see more clearly. I don't need to be perfect. There is no such thing as being perfectly healed. And I'm further along than where my clients are, and I can help them to come up to where I am on my healing journey. And that's what's really powerful. And knowing that all the experiences that I went through that were so dark and so painful, that now they mean something, that actually they're a force for good, a force for growth, for evolution, for light and happiness in people's lives and a sense of fulfillment, that's deeply healing for me. It means that the things that I struggled with actually now have a purpose.
It's very, very niche what you do. And this is this the only thing you focus on with your coaching?
It is, yes. I only work with people who have an anxious attachment style. That kind of answers the question naturally for them of, why Chris? Because I've been there. I know all the techniques. I know about every way to stalk someone on Snap Maps and on Insta stories. I know all the ways that they sabotage in their relationships, so I can call them out on it. Also, having realized a lot of where my origins of my development of my anxious attachment come from, I can help them to identify that more clearly so that they can validate themselves and stop beating themselves up. Anxious attachers are so hard on themselves. I know this because for many years, I was stuck in a pattern of people-pleasing and perfectionism. And so, yes, what I do is niche because this is my truth. It's what I struggled with for years and years. And after writing my first book, It's Good to See Me Again, which details my healing journey and all the traumas that I've brought up today, and how I found forgiveness for my sister and my mom, and how I learned to set better boundaries and take better care of myself and surround myself with the support that I needed. You know, now it's just, it's a different game, you know, and I want people to know that you don't have to do this work alone, because for many years I felt so isolated, so alone. Like I was the only one in the world who was crazy and clingy and needy. And no, I wasn't any of those things, but I don't want people to struggle in the ways that I did. So that's why I'm doing this work. It has real meaning for me. And again, I have a degree in psychology. And while I didn't, my initial career didn't go down that path, I course corrected after getting laid off from a job in my previous career, which was social media strategy and marketing. So this is what I was meant to do all along. The seeds were there. I knew it. I think I needed to go through a lot of the experiences that I did to realize that I can do this. You know, ultimately, maybe in another life, I would have become a therapist. In this life, I'm teaching from experience, you know, and from all the mistakes that I made and what I've learned along the way from those mistakes.
So you've got a degree in psychology, right? But you also come with a lot of experience. Which one of the two is most valuable in your line of work, do you think?
Definitely the experience.
Yeah.
The experience 100%, because it's one thing to understand conceptually models of attachment and attachment theory, and that's definitely helpful. Mm. It's another thing to be able to see someone in their struggle and say, I get it. Mm. I've been there. I know what that's like, and I feel for you so deeply. But if you behave in these ways, here's where the path is leading. Mm. You can't do that anymore. And you need to start holding yourself accountable. That's why coaching is so transformative, because, you know, for a lot of my clients, they're reaching out to me after having worked with therapists for many years and making a good amount of progress. Again, because a lot of therapy modalities focus on cognitive techniques. This isn't me trying to disparage therapy, because obviously it was critical in my own healing. But many folks, you know, don't understand that healing is 20% cognitive and 80% somatic. It's felt. There are imprints on your body. Trauma is stored in the body. Mm-hmm. There's a book that goes into this, The Body Keeps the Score. And it's, you know, a classic for a reason, because healing from trauma has to be both cognitive and behavioral, yes, but also somatic and physiological. You get triggered, and it's not something that you do consciously. It happens automatically in the body. These are conditioned responses. I felt this too for many years, the trigger of someone pulling away, not texting you back, wondering, do they really feel the same way about me, struggling to set boundaries. For sure. I mean, it's all rooted in nervous system overreactivity or underreactivity, dysregulation. So understanding that is critical for healing.
Right. So if we're looking at how to work with the somatic responses within trauma, what is the best way to then start to heal that? Explain somatic responses, I think, in a bit more depth, and then something you're passionate about in your line of work and how to overcome that.
Yes. So again, trauma is stored in the body. So if you've experienced loss, death, abandonment, either physically or emotionally, abuse, neglect, instability. Yep. These are all traumatic experiences. And like I mentioned earlier, sometimes it's also what you didn't get. Sometimes it's the parent that couldn't be as emotionally available to you as a child as you had hoped. Maybe they didn't sit with you and ask you how you're feeling. Maybe feelings weren't even up for discussion in your household. Mm. These are, again, all imprints that are stored in the nervous system. The nervous system's primary goal is to keep you safe. It is wired for protection. This is evolutionarily basic circuitry in the system. Mm-hmm. Your limbic and emotional brain are at the center of your brain, connected directly to your brain stem. That's because, again, evolutionarily speaking, this is the mammalian and the reptilian brain. That's why triggers are so automatic. And what many people don't realize is when you are triggered, so when you do go through a perceived threat, an experience where someone's pulling away and you think that, you know, you're going to get abandoned, the blood in your brain goes immediately to the center of your brain. So you can no longer access higher levels of thinking, language, problem solving, conflict resolution. It becomes very hard. So when it comes to healing somatically, it is consistency that is the key, especially because for so many of us, it is inconsistent, unstable, traumatic experiences that led to the imprints that we have. So that comes from a space of powerlessness. You know, many of us are very young. We're kind of at the whim of our caregivers and the people around us. We can't always pick and choose the experiences that we go through. It's just how childhood is kind of structured. But as an adult, you can make powerful choices that change these imprints and that change your circuitry. This is not fixed. It's called an attachment style for a reason. Mm. This is a style of relating to others that is learned through experiences and relationships that you've had previously. Mm-hmm. So again, consistency is the key. It's what you do day in and day out that changes the game. Now, for many of the clients I work with, they might meditate, they might do yoga, they might journal, they have some tools. And anxious attachers are deeply aware. They're very self-aware, but they lack consistency. They don't use the tools that they have on a consistent basis. This is not to blame anyone, but it's what you do every day that adds up to healing more so than these kind of grand sweeping moments or aha milestones that we reach in our journey. It's what you do every day that matters. So you have to take care of your vessel, your container, your physical, your spiritual, your emotional self better, more consistently. You need good sleep. You need good nutrition. The gut is called the second mind for a reason. This is where your neurotransmitters are built in your body by what you're putting into your body. So many of my clients are, you know, lacking in their nutrition. And while I'm not a nutrition coach, I give them some tips on what they can realistically, you know, look at. Things like magnesium, vitamin D, vitamin B complex.
Definitely.
Those are just some of the essentials.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. I mean, being a PT and obviously valuing health, fitness, nutrition, mindset. I know many years ago when I was actually smoking and my nutrition could have been a little bit better, a bit more consistent. It was pretty good. It's always been pretty good growing up. I've never been overweight or anything. But, you know, when you're young and you're going out every weekend and you're smoking, and I wasn't much of a drinker, but you're sort of like you're eating out more often. Sometimes you're skipping meals, all that sort of stuff. It does play a massive impact against your gut health. And, you know, I was having a couple of bloating issues and, but just more anxious, more anxious for nothing. So if you're smoking, guaranteed you've got some form of anxiety just because it puts so much pressure on your heart health naturally.
Yeah.
Lack of sleep, you're always going to wake up far more anxious, have more cravings. So all these things do play a massive, massive role. So, you know, you are what you eat at the end of the day. So if you're eating crap, you know, all of those nerves that run from your stomach run directly into your brain. It's not theory, it's fact. So, yeah, so taking care of all of that, all of the physical, all the nutritional stuff can play a huge, huge role into your mental health. So don't overlook
it. It does.
Yeah, yeah.
It really does.
Therapy is one way to fix it, but looking at your food, sleep, and exercise is probably going to be the quickest way to get through most of it as well. So, and
absolutely.
I speak from experience. Speak from experience of someone that suffered with anxiety for a number of years, and I found exercise to be one of the most amazing things to help, like, settle it. So,
absolutely, challenging the body in that way is such a game changer.
Yep.
This is why cold exposure as well is super powerful for learning to build tolerance in the nervous system. So in my program, I have what's called a daily, and I'm using air quotes, self-care practice. This is kind of a more colloquial way of describing nervous system regulation. So I have my clients practice cold exposure in the shower. It adds up over time because you're giving the body an actual threat to respond to. You're kind of practicing that response, that trauma or survival response that your body goes into when it has a perceived threat, like in your relationships. Mm-hmm. Meditation is also a game changer. Practicing gratitude, obviously sleep, all of these are core components of health, and your body is a fully integrated system. So exercising, yes, your cardiovascular health, your gut health, all of these things are interrelated. So the more that you can consistently do these things day in and day out, the better off you are. And what you're doing is you're training your body that you can have stability, mm-hmm. that you can give yourself, you can reparent yourself mm-hmm. in ways that you did not get from your actual parents.
Yeah. Yeah. Is your father still around?
No, he passed away last year.
Wow, Chris. So do you have any family left where you are?
I do have a sister, Jennifer, who lives in Los Angeles in California. Mm-hmm. She's a little older. We weren't raised under, you know, the same roof because we're 15 years apart.
Yep.
But especially in the wake of, you know, the death of our father, we've grown very, very close. So we talk a lot now. She's the one remaining person in my nuclear family. You know, she's experienced a lot of loss too, and it's brought us closer together, most certainly. Mm. I also have aunt and uncles and cousins too that I'm very close with.
Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. Fantastic. And are you married? Is that right?
I am not. No, I am single.
Oh, okay. I thought you, all right, cool. I mixed that one up because I thought there was a partner in the picture. What have your relationships been like since your healing journey? Are they a lot better? Because,
oh my goodness.
Again, it's a work in progress. And uh-huh. you know, when you start your healing journey, I find that each partner will feel like you're making better and better progress with each person. But obviously until you meet the one, right? There are obviously still lessons to learn. And this is the thing about trauma. Trauma can really mess stuff up for you for a very long time. And it's such a process to undo all the things that your body really, your body's like a sponge. It just holds on to so much. We don't really, I think we underestimate, because you don't know what you don't know, just how much emotional, physical, mental energy that our body really clings on to. And the process of removing that, it's almost like going through fat loss. It's so much harder than putting on weight gain, isn't it? It's such a process.
Yes.
And we're never really 100% healed. So where are you at now romantically? Because if we're linking this back to relationships, right, how healthy are your connections now with others? Or where are you? Do you want to talk about that? Like, where are you at with
that? Yeah, let's do that, because I think it's so important for people to hear this. Again, you don't have to be perfectly healed. There is no such thing to be in a relationship. And this expectation of perfectionism of, oh, well, once I do this work, then I'll be ready for a relationship. No one's ever really ready to be exposed and vulnerable and to take emotional risks. We do it because the person in front of us is worth it, or so we think. And in the years since I've started doing this work, since I started my healing journey now over 18 years ago, you know, that was half a lifetime ago for me. I feel like a completely different person now. I have the stability in my life that I've craved because I've given it to myself. This house that I'm in right now in Charleston, South Carolina is a manifestation, a symbol of the end of a 32-year trauma arc in my life. When my parents divorced when I was 2 years old, you know, I didn't have a home. I was raised in an apartment in the suburbs of Baltimore, Maryland. That meant when I graduated high school and my dad, you know, who had a stroke the year before and had moved away, it's all very complicated. I didn't really have a place to go home to. When I was in college, I didn't feel like I had a home to go home to. In New York, I rented apartments for 12 years. Now I own a home, and I've given myself the roots and the stability that I've always craved. And that was a game changer for me. Yeah. I've also learned to open up about how I feel. Thank you. About how I feel, especially early on in dating and discussing deal breakers and things that matter most to me. These are things that most people avoid talking about altogether, but especially early on. And yet they're the most important things to us. So I talk about love languages, attachment styles, deal breakers, boundaries, the soonest I can from the first date. And this is not meant to be universal dating advice for everyone, because this works specifically for anxious attachers, because we tend to grasp on really quickly. We develop feelings very quickly. So learning to talk about the things up front that are most important to us and weed out people who don't know or aren't ready or are unsure is very important, because otherwise we'll get attached very quickly. So I've learned to talk about these things early on, maybe even before I meet folks. And again, this isn't for everyone. It works for me. It makes me to feel, it helps me feel like, you know, I'm honoring myself and centering myself in my dating experiences and using it as a chance to get to know, okay, well, to what extent is this person aligned with me? To what extent do we share similar values or a vision for the future? How emotionally intelligent are they? For anxious attachers, we crave communication, connection, closeness. So we need partners that can actually provide that. And yet we shy away from having those conversations because of a fear of abandonment and also a sense of shame or a fear of being unworthy of love or not good enough or too much. So I've learned to honor these things about myself and talk about them from the get-go. I don't beat myself up anymore when I experience anxiety. I put my hand on my heart. I close my eyes. I picture a younger version of me. I soothe him. I talk to him. I let him know he's safe. It is okay to experience anxiety. I say, look, buddy, it's all right. You've got this. It's okay to be unsure. It's okay to be in a space of uncertainty. You can cope with this and it will not last forever. And of course it passes. But talking to myself in a more affirming, validating way has changed the nature of my relationships. Learning to set boundaries in friendships and with family, saying, no, that doesn't work for me, or I'm not going to be able to accommodate that. I'm not free. I'm not available. Just saying no in various forms is so powerful. A no to somebody else is a yes to yourself. And obviously, relationships are reciprocal, and adult relationships are conditional. The condition being, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. So I know I have to be flexible, and my boundaries are flexible these days. They're not so rigid. But that said, learning how to set them started in my mid-20s, when I started learning how to say no to external things that weren't good for me. Things like casual sex that only made me feel worse about myself. Things like going out all the time, having a busy, packed to the brim schedule. These are coping mechanisms. If you look at it through that lens, you can start to change your life, start to change your day-to-day. And that's what the game changer is.
We spoke about on the podcast, episode 17, the three attachment styles. We really broke it down in that in one of those earlier episodes. So if you're listening on Instagram as well, you can go back and have a listen to that. But we probably could have asked this at the beginning of this episode, but sort of just to really understand the key differences between the three styles. How does the anxious attachment differ from other attachment styles, such as avoidant or secure attachment? And what are some key differences in how individuals with these attachment styles approach relationships?
So with the spectrum of attachment, and this is how I like to look at it, because again, no one is perfectly aligned with a label as human beings. We're complex, we're very nuanced. So you might be partially secure and partially anxious, like I consider myself to be nowadays. But that said, most folks have a predominant style of being in relation to others that they learn through experiences and relationships growing up and in early adulthood. The anxious attachment style is on the insecure side of the attachment spectrum. We talked about this a lot today. These are folks who have a deep-seated fear of abandonment. They're afraid of getting cheated on, being left, of their partner pulling away. They need a lot of closeness a lot of reassurance, a lot of clarity about where they stand in their relationships. Again, this is neither good nor bad. This is an adaptation that folks have developed based on the traumas and experiences that they have been through. Okay.
Yeah.
But on the avoidance side of things, they're completely opposite of the anxious person. Their core beliefs, their coping mechanisms, they're complete opposites. They have a very strong sense of self. Someone who is avoidantly attached is almost like a lone wolf. That's how I like to describe it. So they're like a rolling stone. I'm good on my own. I don't need people. They look at vulnerability and talking about feelings as almost a weakness because they've got themselves. I don't need anybody else. I don't need you. I got me. And, you know, what this means is they have a deep need for space and autonomy and time for themselves. Their biggest fears aren't necessarily abandonment, at least not at the conscious level. Although unconsciously, they are afraid of that as well. They're most afraid of intimacy and also of losing their sense of autonomy or independence. They hate any sense of being controlled or manipulated, blackmailed. Anything in that area will trigger them tremendously. They also hate conflict. They love the status quo in the relationship. They sweep things under the rug.
Yep.
They're called dismissive avoidance for a reason. They dismiss their own emotions. And by extension, they dismiss others as well. They feel this most acutely in romantic relationships, just like the anxious attacher. But their needs are completely opposite of the anxious person. So that's how those two styles differ.
With what would have happened in childhood for the anxious attachment versus the avoidant, that one craves attention and the other one shies away from it, essentially?
Great question. And I want to caveat this by saying that it's always the interpretation of the child that leads to the style of attachment.
Yeah.
Okay. So there are situations in which you can experience the same trauma, and based on how you perceive it, that leads to your way of relating to others. But that said, anxious attachers, just like me, have oftentimes experienced abuse, neglect, instability. And you can see that in what I shared from my own experiences today. I experienced emotional abandonment. I experienced actual physical abandonment through the loss of my mom and my sister, and also my father, all before the age of 35. Poof, there goes my nuclear family. Of course, yeah. I would be anxious.
Yeah.
So those kinds of situations lead to anxious attachment. Avoidant attachment is different. So many avoidant attachers have experienced enmeshment with a parent. So enmeshment being a parent who overly relies on their child for their own emotional stability, who overshares, who parentifies their children from a very early age. A lot of times this can be a result of divorce in particular, because that rips apart the family and that puts the child in the middle a lot of times.
Mm.
So they learn, I have needy people in my life, quote unquote, that need to rely on me. So I need to be strong enough to be there for them. Whereas the anxious person is afraid of being left, the avoidant person feels that they need to be the rock, the stable person. So those experiences growing up, they typically have been controlled. It's why they are so triggered by it. They've had a parent that was a helicopter parent in a lot of ways. So that typically leads to avoidant attachment. And on the secure side of things, again, remembering that no one is perfectly secure, they have typically experienced enough stability. Again, looking at this as a spectrum instead of absolutes, they've experienced enough stability to learn warmth, openness, closeness, and they move in relationships with relative ease. So they can open up, talk about how they feel, set boundaries, or at least, you know, say no to things that don't work for them. Whereas a lot of what makes someone be on the insecure side of the attachment spectrum is the way in which they communicate, or rather the way in which they do not.
Some massive realizations there. There's a lot that goes into this. And I think that when people understand this, you know, you can make some big breakthroughs within your own healing. It can sort of be a lot to take this on at first, you know, and again, for those listening on Instagram, when you come to the realization of, you know, I am needy for these reasons, it's like a kick in the guts and go, oh, it really wasn't my fault, was it? You know, I had these parents who for the longest time I would often be kind of gaslit out of my reaction to certain things, and I was told I was probably crazy or, you know, for feeling this way. And again, trauma takes on a certain interpretation. Sometimes it's not about was it really that traumatic, or was it in that moment you took it as a traumatic experience and your body has for the longest time held on to that thought ever since. And then you kind of look at it from the other side and go, well, what was the parent going through that the child felt that, for example, parents always working away, never really being present for the child. The child will see that as neglect. The parent, on the other hand, is like, well, we had to work two jobs to put food on the table as much as we wanted to be there. We were doing what we thought was right at the time, and that was working so much. But, you know, it's just.
This is so important. Yep. So important for healing. Yep. And what you just described about the parent doing the best that they could is oftentimes the truth. They were doing the best that they could with the knowledge and the tools that they had. And that is where many people can find forgiveness. Yep. That's how I found forgiveness for my mom. She didn't know how to cope. That's why she turned to alcohol. Yep. My sister didn't know how to cope. It's why she turned to drugs in the wake of our mom's death. And for many years, I didn't know how to cope. So I turned to alcohol, sex. So, you know, learning these things about yourself and realizing that these are skills that you can hone, especially if you did not have these skills modeled for you or taught to you growing up, you can seek it out as an adult. And coaching is a very powerful environment for this, considering the accountability and the practicality of it. But yes, parents are doing the best that they can. And still, the child can experience trauma as a result of that. Both of those things can be true.
Yeah.
Both of those versions of reality are valid. And that's why this is not about blaming parents or shaming them. And many parents, when a child is old enough to realize their patterns and some of their own trauma, can get extremely defensive because they think that they're being blamed for this. No, it's not about blame. Because you can be doing the best that you can with the tools you have and with the time and energy that you have as a parent, and trauma can still be caused as a result.
Absolutely. And there's a lot more we could probably go into this, but we're sort of getting to that time of the morning. So from here, I think people need to come and ask you the questions directly and start getting some more custom answers based on their own situation. So if you're like me or Chris and you had that attachment or the anxious attachment style where you might have been labelled as a bit needy, or you can tell within yourself that you get triggered by people not responding to texts on time, or communication is sort of hit and miss, or you just naturally find yourself drawn to the avoidant character, but there is that passion there. Knowing how to have a really healthy relationship and re-establishing some of those values, Chris is your man to speak to. So, Chris, you've got a blog that you do. Yep.
I do.
Blog, is that available on your website?
It is, yes. I have a ton of free content on my website, which is cracklife.com, CRACKLIFFE, or cracklife with two Fs.com. It's my first initial and last name, Chris Rackliff.com. Yep. If you go to /coaching there on my website, you can find out details about my coaching philosophy, some testimonials, and also sign up for a free consultation with my team.
Yep. Amazing. All right. Chris, it's been amazing to chat with you today. I didn't feel like I had to really ask you too many questions. You just sort of came out with everything today. So it was amazing. And
thank you.
Again, when we spoke offline, there was a bunch of information I took down, but as I'm reading through those notes, you're just boom, hitting each point. So yeah, fantastic to listen to you just really open up about today. And I'm excited for those that will potentially come and work with you. When you're not working in such a serious space, what do you really enjoy doing in your free time?
I love reading. I'm a sponge. I'm constantly reading nonfiction books, fiction books. Yeah. My friends and I just started a book club here in Charleston.
Yeah.
We're actually going, tomorrow is a full moon. We're going on the beach to celebrate that. So I've got my witchy kind of spiritual community that I built around me here in Charleston, South Carolina. And, you know, I've got a great group of friends. We're constantly on the water here. It's beautiful almost year round. So I'm out in nature a lot. I work out with a trainer 3 times a week, constantly practicing cold exposure and just taking care of myself.
Yep. Yep. I've been doing cold showers in the mornings myself, and it just instantly just wakes you up.
It's a game changer.
3 books that you recommend and 3 benefits to cold showers, and then we're going to wrap it up.
Okay. 3 books I would recommend. This is such a tough one because there's so many books that really changed my life. I actually have 2 blogs on my site that go into this, 13 books that changed my life and 9 books that changed my love life.
Yep.
So there's already 22 in the top there. But picking some of my personal favorites, The Untethered Soul by Michael A. Singer. What a beautiful way of thinking about energy and learning to sit with yourself and really diving deeper into the self, into your soul, your spirit. Mm-hmm. Learning to slow down, to understand that you don't need to respond so quickly, that there's no urgency. So, so important. And there's so much wisdom in that book, The Untethered Soul by Michael A. Singer. Mm. The Body Keeps the Score is a game changer.
You mentioned that.
And for me, it really helped me to better contextualize how this work really is deeply somatic, because the body has so many imprints in it. So thinking your way out of your feelings or trying to think your way out of trauma, it doesn't work. That one was a game changer for me as well.
That book sounds
thinking amazing. About the third and final one. Oh, this is so tough. Probably A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson. That was a game changer for me as well. And it's, I mean, if you saw my copy of the book, there's so much underlined, so many like pages that are dog-eared and stars in the margins. There's just so much powerful truth in A Return to Love. So I would say those 3, and that kind of provides a balance too of kind of, you know, research-based, more spiritual type. And that really hints at who I am as a person. I tend to take a more holistic approach to this work. And so, you know, that helps people to better understand me and the way that I look at myself and also the work I do with clients.
Fantastic.
So cold exposure.
Yes.
3 benefits.
3 benefits. Yep.
1, it builds tolerance in the nervous system. Again, you're practicing what it's going to be like when your system is activated by a trigger. You're giving the body an actual threat. The body has the same survival response regardless of whether it's in actual danger or perceived danger. So this is a way to really set yourself up for success for the next time that you do feel triggered, regardless of what triggers you. So it's recommended that folks aim for about 10 minutes a week of cold exposure to really, really see the benefits. But start where you are and realize this is free. You can access it every day in the shower, 15 seconds, 30 seconds, do what you can.
Yep.
The 2 variables are time and temperature. You don't have to go for the full length of the shower and you don't have to use the coldest possible water. Work your way up to those things. 2nd benefit, your hair and your skin are going to be glowing as a result of cold exposure in the shower. It helps to really close the pores in both your hair and also your skin. Mm-hmm. So it has great, great benefits for both of those things. And also, 3rd benefit, this brings us closer to our evolutionary beginnings. Human beings didn't evolve with hot water. Hot water is something relatively new to our society. I say relatively because, you know, past couple hundred years.
Yeah.
But the history of humanity goes thousands of years and probably far further back than we actually realize in modern science.
Sure.
That said, it's a return to our roots. So our system, you know, it learned certain ways of being, and returning to them can feel very, very helpful and powerful.
Yeah.
So those are the 3 benefits I would name.
And are you having cold showers or ice baths? How are you achieving cold therapy?
I do both. So I do cold exposure in the shower every day, and I also go to cryotherapy and do cold plunges.
Amazing. Okay. Yeah. So I highly recommend anyone listening out there, definitely start with cold shower, start basic. something I need to do is an ice bath. Years ago, I did a, it's called Tough Mudder, which is, it's an obstacle course. Yeah. Yep, it's an obstacle course. You get put through your paces, you face a lot of your fears. We had to jump into an ice pool and swim to the other side and then get out. And it just literally takes your breath away. So there wasn't time to adjust to it. It was just like, get me out of here as quick as I can, because it's like I can't breathe. But I think what I love about just jumping straight into a bath is you're being taught how to relax and how to breathe, and the body just tends to adjust. Anyway, Chris, it's been brilliant. Thank you so, so much. All of Chris's details will be below. You can purchase his book by the link below as well and have a read of that. And also, if you want to work with Chris personally, head to his website, head to that coaching section, and also check out his free resources on the website. And again, give us a review either on Spotify or on iTunes. We're on Google. We are on six other platforms. You can see all those links available in the show notes below. Chris, thank you so much for your time today. Much love.
Thank you, Amanda. I'm deeply grateful. Powerful conversation today.